Vaisheshika states that the universe has two aspects, one eternal and one non-eternal. The eternal constituents of the universe are the four kinds of atoms, earth, water, fire, and air, and the five substances, space, time, direction, mind, and self. These are not subject to change, and they can be neither created nor destroyed. Another part of the universe is not eternal, that is, subject to creation and destruction in a particular time and space. In the beginning of creation, two atoms are united into a dyad, which is non-eternal because it can be divided again into two. The dyads and atoms cannot be perceived but are known through inference. The combination of three dyads is called a triad, trayanuka, which is the smallest perceptible object. It is from these triads that other larger compounds develop. Thus, the common elements, comprised of eternal atoms, are non-eternal because they can be broken down into smaller units. So as he stated before, is that the smallest, the eternal means something that can't be divided. And so once that has come to that point, that's eternal. So the existence of the four elements and of the, what do you call it? The space, time, direction, mind, and self, that is eternal. I guess it didn't expect that the fan was on. Last time it came, it was off. So, so that, because whatever is created can be divided again back into atoms. So therefore it says there's the eternal and then the non-eternal, right? So we'll basically speaking agree with that principle. The difficulty is he is not understanding the manifestation of and non-manifestation of the material elements. And the self is also combined as coming from, is atoms. It is coming from the material energy. So we see here is even though he believes in a supreme will, it's still this concept is covered by mundane logic. And so the living entities are coming from the atoms. I mean, they are atoms that... They are coming from there, means how you say. They interact with the rest of the creation that's manifest from the various atoms and then is influenced by the time, space, direction, and mind. But the understand the supreme will, all this is absorbed back in him and then manifests again. And that the souls are separate from the material energy, this then is not understood. Right? So here we see is that even though there's a belief in a supreme being, and that supreme being has control of this world, still the fullness, completeness of his control is not understood because it is based on mundane logic. And therefore, it will have similar difficulties, though not to the degree of modern philosophies and religions, because there's more of a consistency here. Yes. Yes, like that. That's how you can understand. That's one of the ways you can understand the mundane aspect, like that. Because if you define, means that when they're defining their process, you can't necessarily tell if it is atheistic or theistic, or if it's, you know, what is the mood. Just like if we describe a car. Right, how it works and everything like that. But just because we've described the mechanics of the car, you know, there's the engine and then the drive shaft and then the wheels and the driver and all that, that still hasn't defined its position. But when the driver is just driving down to the 7-Eleven to pick up a six-pack, then it's mundane. But now if the driver is getting in the car driving to the temple or some preaching program, then you're not dealing with the mundane. You understand? So, therefore, these definitions is when they start defining the soul, God, material energy, and the relationship, that's when you know, start to understand we're there. Then when they define their process and then the ultimate goal, that's then where you confirm what is their philosophy. But these five only are what you have to look at. So it's not that when you're dealing with others' philosophies or religions, because they have such a broad spectrum of their own understandings, their own theology, and they have their own way of presenting it. But you don't have to worry about that. You simply have to ask, who is God? What is His nature? What is His relationship, you know, with the souls, with the material energy? What is material energy? What's its relationship with the souls and God? What is the jiva? What is the soul? What's its relationship with material energy and God? What's the process by which the jiva is elevated? You know, and having been elevated, what is his position in relationship with God? You know these things because most people don't have good answers for these. So you save yourself days of discussion because they only discuss about things they have theology on. But on these five topics, they basically don't have much theology. So from that, you can get down to exactly what is going on in their particular philosophy or religion. That makes sense? Yeah? Okay. The entire universe is a systematic arrangement of physical things and living beings that interact with one another in time, space, and direction. Right? Time, space, direction. Okay, then why they're interacting will be the mind. Right? So the soul or the self is interacting with the earth, water, fire, air, that has positioned itself in ether, in space, according to direction, time. Space is put on that side. Space, time, and direction. So the earth, water, fire, and air is formed into things that you can observe and interact with. That will then be resting in space, and it will be governed by time and direction. Right? Then the living entity, according to their mind, what is their interest and their previous karma, will be in those situations and interacting with it. Right? Does that make sense? So it's a very interesting observation of the material energy. You can see as their observations by these Vedic authorities is much greater than the greatest mundane scholars and intellectuals. But it falls short because why is the jiva there? Why is the karma there? What is going on? That is not explained because that is beyond what they can see. Right? You can see the 24 elements. You can't actually see what's beyond. So that's where it falls short.
So the Vedic
speech
is
Well, here is that mind seems to be the only thing that's mentioned. Now, mind within that may include the intelligence, the false ego, all those different things like that. But the difficulty comes is how much it's expanded or not. It means the 24 elements are there. How you define them, because you can wind them up into much smaller. You can just say mind, and that includes the senses, the sense objects, the tanmatras, the sense of smell, touch, taste, like this. So, and the working senses. So right there, 20 things get wound up into one. You know what I'm saying?
So because they don't have a Christian picture, everything becomes mundane.
Everything becomes mundane, even though it's very intellectual, because there is a, I think in this here, we have to see what's his concept, but there's a cessation, I think, of the soul. Like that. So therefore, then that would bring it into mundane because the soul is never. They're dealing with pradhan, but I don't think they're seeing it as combined as one thing. They're just seeing that it goes back into the atoms. So they probably never see just the element of the pradhan in its nature and interaction with the Lord. Even though it's the same thing. You know what I'm saying? When all the atoms are just atoms, nothing's manifest, you're dealing with pradhan. But at the same time as the jivas are already there in their concept, as with time-space. So actually they never get back to pradhan, they only get to mahat. Because mahat means everything's been separated. It hasn't been formed into anything, but it's separated. Right? And then the laws of God are there that govern how the atoms will be put together. So that means your primary creation is also included. Though they're not necessarily seeing it as specifically coming from the Lord as by the desires of the living entities.
They see it as from the desires.
Yeah, that's what it mentioned before. The will of the Supreme Being directs the operation of atoms according to the past samskaras of individual beings. So that explains what's going on now, but it doesn't explain why we're in this situation.
Okay, so they're keeping it like it's one big bubble, that there might be some supreme authority that's only there to satisfy our desires.
Basically. But it says according to his supreme will. So then there is some element of his independence. So he's not as, that's what we'll see, is that what you're talking about is what Jaimini says, that the supreme is there only to, because if we don't do an activity, no one can give a result. So actually we're in control of God because we do the activity, therefore. But that's what Krishna used with Nanda Maharaj to get to take Indra out of the picture. If you don't do the sacrifice, then he can't award you the rain. So actually, it's your good work that's actually the main thing, not Indra. So therefore, then with that, having removed Indra, then he emphasized on the work, which said, now you worship Govardhan Hill. What they didn't, but it was presented from the side of work. You're doing this festival for Indra, but because he gave you rain, but he can only give you rain because you did the festival. He's not giving you rain and then you're reciprocating. You're doing your yajna and sacrifice, therefore he's giving rain. So it depends. Your yajna is actually the thing that's making things work, not Indra. He's just responding. So having removed Indra from the picture, then he keeps that same sacrifice that's going to be done, but now he moves it from Indra to Govardhan Hill. You understand? But the emphasis is on the work. So you're not noticing is that while you're worshipping Indra, worship Govardhan Hill. Then there'll be an argument. But you remove Indra from the equation, then it's just your work. Then you shift the work over to Govardhan Hill. So even if you understand what's going on or not, you're still worshipping the Lord. Then he takes it back to, therefore, Govardhan Hill, because he's the one that's supplying everything. You can see him. He's doing it. All these six can be used because all these six are part of the Vedic principle. The problem is when they're used on their own, exclusively, that's where there's a problem. Just like, is there anything wrong with the principle of action? No. But if you take action and make it into its own religion and own philosophy, there's a problem. Because it's not complete without the Lord. Neither is karma, gyan, or neither is yoga. You understand? So that's what's happening, is they're taking parts of the Vedic system and separating them off and trying to make them into a complete unit in itself, which can't, because it'll always have shortfalls like this, because it can't explain everything. So all these systems are used. In other words, the higher ones are used to defeat lower ones. So you see what it is that the person is speaking, and then you use appropriate either within that system or a system above it to defeat it. Once you've defeated it, then you bring it to Krishna consciousness. You know what I'm saying? You know what I'm saying? Why beat someone over the head with Krishna when you can hit him over the head with Jaimini? You know what I'm saying? Why would we want to hit somebody with Krishna?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, yeah.
You know, it's like this. If I can hit the person with someone else's fist, why I should hit him with my fist? You know, and then once you hit him, then he's submissive. Now we talk philosophy. You understand? So all these are different. So you see the way the atomic theory is working, it's not atheistic, technically. But if it's as its own theory, as Vaisheshika is doing, then it falls short. But as atoms are there in the primary creation, in the Mahatattva, and then from there, by Krishna's will, then there's the manifestation through Brahma, then that's there, and then it goes back. So it's the same thing. But we understand the people involved and what's higher and what's going on. But Vaisheshika is only looking at the atomic theory. He's not looking beyond that, really. Yes, because then you can come to an impersonal understanding. Because if all it is these mechanics, so there's a higher being, but still, you know, you're just part of that mechanics according to your samskaras. So you step out of that, then you're unhappy because you have samskaras. You step out of interacting based on that samskaras, then you'll be happy. So that's just a mundane. It's just another form of Buddhism. That's all. No, that's the meaning of Mayaya Pratijnana. Very intelligent. Don't understand. Now, to this degree of intelligence, they can be illusions. So why can't somebody else? Why can't just a modern day academic be illusions, or a modern day scientist? Because their theories are so much less developed than these people. You know what I'm saying? It's very hard to find holes in these philosophies. But if you understand Vedanta, you can.
Yeah.
Like that. It's easy to see, and also what's very interesting is that you see these things going on around you.
Yeah.
That's the more fun.
I was talking with someone earlier about something, quite an example from here, and how I should say, going on around so much.
Yeah. So, it's understood because that's part of conditioning. So it's not a problem if somebody doesn't make a philosophy out of it. They may think that way, and then you show them the proper position in Krishna consciousness, and they accept that. Or there may be some more doubt or some deeper, but it's not because it's a philosophy, but it's just how they perceive, so you have to change their perception. Then that's considered, that is just the purificatory process. But if someone actually stands on that, makes their identity based on that, professes that, then you have a problem, because that's not sincere. Yeah, then it becomes mundane. So that's not allowed, even though it may be very respected in the material world. It's not respected in the circle of transcendentalists. You know what I'm saying? It means actual transcendentalists.
Western concept of the atom, the form, correlates anyhow to the Vedic?
Well, the Vedic is the atom in here is the smallest thing that you can't divide it. So the problem is the modern thing that they call an atom, they can divide them. And here it's saying it's the put them, six of them together, it's the smallest thing you can see. So already they're seeing stuff. You know what I'm saying? So it's smaller than what they're talking about, because they're not divisible. But now they can take them and divide them. So according to this, it's indivisible. Like that. So it's got to be something smaller than what they're working with now.
We actually met with Swartra Maharaj, one of the physicists.
Okay.
He said that this whole Western concept, it's just so the needle, how they are measuring it, just a probability in mathematics. And he said that when you put a needle like that, it keeps this picture, but it's just probability in mathematics. They have never seen any atom, they will never see any atom.
Yeah.
And he said when they change the needle, the picture will be something which can be never presented in the school books. So he said it's just a guess.
It's just a guess, yeah. So that's the thing, it's a theory. But so here is then he's working on this, because he says the atom you can't see. Only when six atoms are put together, then it's big enough to start to be able to see. But otherwise, before that, it's not. That's why you see time starts from the atom. So that means time, your movement, your space, everything's starting from the atom. So that's the size that it builds from. So even the Bhagavatam deals with that, but it doesn't. It's not our philosophy. It's just a way of explaining that what everything is going back and back to. Does that make sense? Does this? What's the difference between impersonalism and voyeurism? The impersonalists, they become?
They become an atom and then become a
gelatin. Okay, and then but what happens to them? They're just there, but the point is do they exist or not? They exist. Do they agree with that? Mayavadis will say you don't exist. Okay? So the Buddhists will say you don't exist. The only difference is one you merge into nothingness, the other one you merge into Brahman. You know what I'm saying? So, but of course, this soul is eternal, so even there in that Brahman, there's still an individual in the Brahman. Right? But it's not... But the problem is, as soon as they identify themselves as an individual in Brahman, then what are they going to interact with? And since they only know mundane, that means the material world, so you're again back in mundane consciousness. But if you understand that you're the soul, you come to the Brahman platform, but you're a servant of Krishna, then on that platform, the transcendental platform, you interact with the Supreme Lord. So voidism and impersonalism are basically the same thing. It's just slightly different, little variations in their presentation, but otherwise the same. So all karma is the same, all jnana is the same. It's just there'll be some fine differences within the different viewpoints of it, but it's the same point. One, karma means everything's coming from material energy, so the soul, the actions, the results, everything's coming from there. So you do good work, then by the laws of nature you get good reactions. You do bad work, you get bad reactions. Right? And then the jnana is that even I do good work, I still end up with some bad things, so I can never actually be happy. So the only real way to be happy is to give up all material endeavors. So that means then removing yourself from that whole picture, so you just stop to exist. And so therefore, that way I'll become happy. Right? But the problem is the one is if my consciousness, me being happy, is coming from dead matter, consciousness moves matter. So how would matter be actually superior to consciousness? So that doesn't work. So it can't be that the matter is giving me the happiness. And the other is if I'm going to dissolve my existence, and that way I'll be happy, how will I know I'm happy? I can only know I'm happy, experience happiness, if I'm an individual experiencing it. You know what I'm saying? So both of these theories have big problems to them. You know, and then you have detail of each individual school. Like that. Does that make sense? So each school figures they're right and everybody else is wrong. But they all fit into these two basic categories. All mundane philosophy fits into these two. The entire universe is a systematic arrangement of physical things and living beings that interact with one another in time, space, and direction. Living beings are the souls of the selves who enjoy or suffer in this world, depending on their meritorious or non-meritorious past impressions. Thus, according to Vaisheshika philosophy, the world is a moral stage on which the life and destiny of all living individual beings are governed, not only by the physical laws of time and space, but also by the moral law of karma. In the performance of present karma, an individual is free and is thus the creator of his own destiny. But the starting and ending point of the universe depends on the creative or destructive will of the Supreme Being, God. The universal law, adrishta, of the process of creation and annihilation influences the individual cells to function or to be active in the direction of the creative will. Direction by this unknown force of adrishta, the soul makes contact with an atom of air. Thus, the primeval motion comes into being. That primeval activity in air atoms creates dyads, triads, and the rest of the gross physical manifestations of air elements, mahabhutas. In a similar matter, there arises motion in the atoms of fire, water, and earth, which then compose the gross elements of fire, water, and earth. In this way, the vast expansion of the physical world comes into existence. So the living entity is independent, so he governs what situation he's going to be in, according to his good and bad activities. But the actual beginning of this process and the end of this process, that's in the hands of the Supreme. Like that. So when the living entity has an interest to come in contact, by his desire, he comes in contact with the atom of air, then that atom will then start connecting with other atoms and develop and become that actual item that he's supposed to interact with according to his karma. Does that make sense? So it's all coming. So like when we describe it, we don't get into this detail. How the mechanics work, it's not really as important. So we understand the Paramatma is there. We have a desire. He sanctions that. Then the material energy through the modes of nature make everything work. Right? So this is not dealing so much with that side of it as it is with the mechanics of how the atoms are coming together and coming apart. You understand the difference? Like that. The Supreme Lord is endowed with perfect wisdom, detachment and excellence, jnana, vairagya and aishwarya. He releases the adrishta related to the individual beings. So the adrishta is the universal law. Right? So the Lord is in control of the universal law. And that universal law then is applied on the living entity. So according to the living entity's previous work, he releases that, and then it starts to act. In other words, Paramatma sanctions, and then Maya then affects everything like that. But they're not seeing it like that. They're just seeing that this action or reaction is happening by the will of the Lord. He releases the adrishta related to individual beings, which guides the individuals in their flow through the currents of life. At the end of life, the process of dissolution or annihilation also depends on the will of God. He inspires the adrishta corresponding to the individual or to the universe, and then a destructive motion in the atoms of the body and the senses or in the cosmos starts vibrating. On account of this destructive motion, there arises the process of disjunction and disintegration of the body and senses or of the universe. Compound things break down into simpler and simpler compounds, finally devolving into the state of triads and dyads, and ultimately into atoms. In this manner, the physical elements of earth, water, fire, and air, and the related sense organs are disintegrated. After the dissolution of the manifest universe, there remains the four kinds of atoms, earth, water, fire, and air, as well as the eternal substances of space, time, direction, mind, and soul, with their attendant meritorious and non-meritorious samskaras. Right? So, again, it just breaks down, and the souls are just there with their meritorious and unmeritorious deeds. And so next time that the Lord applies this adrishta on the atoms, then everything starts to come together again, and it all starts to work. So there's this constant thing where the Lord is applying the creative force and the destructive force according to the position of the living entities. Right? And then having done that, then we see that it all starts to come together or fall apart. Right? Does this make sense? And so then there's the daily motions that are going on of things being created and destroyed. Then there'll be bigger cycles, the end of the yugas, end of the mahayugas, end of the 14, I say, the Manus, then at the end of the day of Brahma, then at the end of the lifetime of Brahma. So all these different things will be happening. Does that make sense? So in here we see is that they're considered that they're not atheistic on one level because they accept the Supreme Lord and his independence and all that. But you noticed up to now, all that interaction and all that, why it's going on, what's the purpose of it, and any relationship actually between the soul and God hasn't been described. Right? So therefore, technically it's atheistic because the souls are connected with God. Right? But they're considered theistic because they accept the Vedas and the Supreme Will. Yes? Yeah, you could say they get to that degree of things coming apart, going together, but... And
I mean, just the principle of the fact that this whole thing is functioning around us. Like, God's there.
Yeah,
Like, he's there at our disposal.
Yeah, but this has way more answers than they have. But the point is it's, yeah, basically the same thing, is that your religions still fit into the mundane logic. They still don't go beyond that. They don't go to transcendence like that. But yes. that aspect. That's why Bhaktivinoda Thakur is saying that there's only karma and jnana. There's these two basic schools. Within that, there's different schools. Then when both these schools are applied without the relationship to God, then people turn to religions. But it's still the same elements of karma and jnana are applied now within the religion. Right? Now you add God to the equation, and then you come up with these things, rather than material energy or the, you know, nothingness is the supreme. Now you actually have a supreme, you know, cognizant being who is able to you know, guide things and direct things. But that relationship with him is not very well defined, you know, and he basically just becomes the one who organizes and manages things based on the samskara of the living entities. Yes, but why would he be doing that? If he's the supreme being, why does he have to spend his time doing that? Why would he want to do that? We wouldn't have a doubt about it because we are trying to be the supreme controller. So therefore, if someone is the supreme controller, we'll think he's successful. But if he's the supreme controller, why does he need to control this? Why would he do it? You know what I'm saying? So these are where then the thing starts to fall apart.
So then at these points, you can then ask the question at these points. Why? You can say why doesn't this condition...
Yes, yeah, of course. Why is it that just... Okay, you've done good work, you go to heaven. Nice. But why would God want to arrange it like that? You know, why would God make that arrangement? You know, some big carnival or something, you know, and that's it. You know, that's God likes, you know, carnivals or something. Why is it working that way?
And then it will get them to actually analyze deeper.
To bring in the element of love of God and that relationship with God. And that's what's important, not getting the results of your good, pious work. Because that's going to give mundane works, going to give mundane good results. So one should be God conscious. That will give transcendental results. Is that okay? Thus, according to Vaisheshika philosophy, there is no creation and annihilation, but rather an orderly and morally systemized composition and decomposition of compounds. An individual self or soul is involved in the universe because of adrishta. The karma of each soul is its own earnings, deposited in the safe of the Supreme Being, which comes back to the self with interest. The Vaisheshika concepts of God or the liberation of the soul and the path to liberation are all basically the same as the Nyaya concepts, which have already been discussed in the preceding chapter. So if you pull yourself out of the karma, then you know, everything becomes fine. You're not suffering anymore. That's their idea. But here it's that, so it's not that God is creating the whole thing and destroying the whole thing. He's just putting it together and taking it apart. You know, in an orderly way, according to the mechanics, the laws of mechanics of the atoms and laws of morality. In other words, the laws of mechanics of the atoms will create the different forms, but those forms will only be created according to the laws of morality that the living entities function within. So God is there as controller and organizing all these different things, but where does it come from? You know, why is he doing... None of this is there, so they're not worried about that. All they know is it's going on, and I want to get out of here, so that's that much. So, because they're not actually interested in a relationship with Godhead, they don't actually take their philosophies far enough to come to that state. Does that make sense? Yeah, they just... That means, in other words, you're doing all the things, and it's all happening because of this, so if you do good work, you get good results. So through Vaisheshika, you could, and through Nyaya, you could get good results, but their ultimate point is to get beyond that. So they have that element of renunciation, of detachment, knowledge and detachment, you know, which is nice, which is pious, but the problem is that they don't actually come to a permanent solution. Because they don't come to actually understand the position of the soul. They only partially understand it. Enough to either involve themselves in pious work or in their personal path. But, you know, still, you can, that can, like the Buddhists, supposedly they get their perfection, but they don't even believe there is a soul. They think it's an illusion that it's there. It doesn't exist. So, and the Mayavadis will say that the concept of your personal soul is due to illusion. It's actually part of just the greater soul. So it doesn't exist either. So technically they don't actually believe in the existence of the soul. Yes. See, as the soul knows that there is higher, inherent in the soul is the knowledge that happiness is coming from somebody beyond myself. And that activity in relation to it with that person is what's going to give me my happiness. So there we can see from that comes the root of your karma and jnana. Right? Means your karma, you means that through activity you're going to express this, you know, be able to taste this happiness because of interaction with the Supreme, right? So therefore, there's the position of karma. I perform good work, I get good result, I'm happy. I perform bad work, I get bad result, I'm not happy. What we see is that karma means it's not in connection with the Lord. If it's connected with the Lord, then it's not. Then it's karma yoga, right? And then the jnana is that we're seeing that the living entity being, how do you say, that happiness is beyond, not the activities, but it's coming from a supreme source. Therefore, if I absorb myself in that supreme source, then I'll be happy. Right? But in the normal position, the soul understands that's included with the action. But in the mundane platform, just as you can separate the activity from the source of that happiness, you think the activity is giving the happiness. In the same way as that source, the original source of existence, you don't see as in connection with activity. Or it's expressed through that activity. So you think just absorbing yourself in the Supreme will make you happy. So that's your basis of jnana. But when you see that connection with the Lord, and He's everything, and we're connected with Him, that's the platform of Parabrahman. So, therefore, it's the first stage in self-realization.
Because it's all the other ones, feel both either by the way they're absorbing in the Lord or absorbing in the action.
Yes.
It's still centered around themselves.
Yes, it's still centered around themselves as opposed to that. But there is that concept, even in both of this, of that selfless work.
Yes.
Both of them will profess selfless work. And some sort of supreme, because if there is no selfless work and there is no supreme, nobody's going to, it's not going to become popular. It will not become popular.
So they don't want to give up their independence, do they? Really,
no, your independence is applied to get either your happiness materially or your happiness so-called and spiritually. But their own happiness is what they're looking for. So, but that's okay on one level because everybody's working for their own happiness. But the point is the ultimate goal your own happiness, or is the ultimate goal the Supreme Lord's happiness? So, and how do you define your happiness? If your happiness is separate from the Lord, or in connection with the Lord, but if it's dependent upon the Lord, in other words, pure devotional service is connected to the Lord. Pure unalloyed devotional service is dependent upon the Lord. The Lord is happy, you're happy. Right? Pure devotional service, I'm happy in things in connection with the Lord. Pure unalloyed is in those things connected with the Lord. When the Lord is happy, His happiness is my happiness. So, do we understand what's happening here? Is the actual technical points of the nature, inherent nature of the soul are being reflected in all modern, means all philosophies and religions and that of the world. But they're not seen in connection with the Lord, so that's what makes them faulty. And because of that, then you get a whole variety of philosophies and religions that develop based on that. You understand how from the inherent nature of the soul that karma and jnana arises? Right? Does that make some sense? Yeah. So that's why we can say very confidently all philosophies go back to karma and jnana. or some combination of that. Because in any case, there's some combination. It means even in karma, you're thinking there's some supreme that is the source of the happiness. So, but the emphasis is on the karma, on the work, doing good work, getting the results of having done good work. But there's the element of the supreme there, whatever the supreme may be. Right? But the emphasis on work, the jnana, then the emphasis on the jnana, and that source of that happiness, that source of that knowledge. And they don't want to get involved in the activities of karma. But whatever work you do should be good, because that will give you better situations and better results. So it also still has some karma mixed in it. So karma and jnana are both there, where you know that I, as the living entity, I am happy, but there's a source of my happiness. And if I absorb myself in that source of happiness, work in that, then I will be happy. But the pure soul sees too, that I'm working and that absorption. While the mundane soul basically sees one or the other. So therefore you get karma again. Right? Then there's any little combination of it. How far is that supreme? If it's within karma, then it's generally within the cycle of that. Since you're dealing with material energy, the supreme actually is material energy. Like that. Or if there's something beyond it, it's still not the source of you. Right? Like in Gotama, it's not, the soul is not coming from God. The soul is coming from material energy. Right? So just like here in Vaisheshika, it's part of this energy that is the eternality of the soul. He's not distinguishing spiritual and material. He's just saying, there's atoms, that's all. So he doesn't distinguish. So he doesn't actually know that there are spiritual atoms. He only knows the mundane. And he doesn't actually know that the soul is from the spiritual atom side, and that the Supreme Lord is the Supreme Soul. So, does this make some sense? In other words, working with the very fundamental principles on which philosophies and everything are based. You can start from that, then you can go out to anything. Because then you don't get distracted by what different philosophers and religionists say. Because, what is the nature? What is the nature of them? Where are they taking it back to? Because they have to take it back to these things. They're a jiva. They have to. You know what I'm saying? That's just the way. No matter where you put the cow, it'll go out in the field and eat grass. You know what I'm saying? No matter where the dog is, it will bark. You know what I'm saying? It's just the way it is. So the soul will find that work has to be done. That work is based on good work and bad work that will give good and good bad results. There is a supreme who is in control of that. Right? And by pleasing that supreme, I will be happy. Right? Now, whether the emphasis is because of the work, I'll be happy from that, or that absorption in the supreme is what will make me happy. So pulling myself away from that work. So good work therefore means doing this higher element of spiritual absorption as opposed to absorption in the mundane activities. You understand? But it's still the same philosophy. It's not different. And so because those are the basis are coming actually from the real Vaishnava philosophy, that's why it doesn't matter who they are, we can explain to them our philosophy, because they always understand work and good work and results, or that existence, and somehow or another coming in contact with a higher existence. Does that make sense? It's just a matter of how much they understand of it. So we can just, starting from there, then we take them where we find out where they are, and then where they are, take them from there to devotional service. Right? Does that make sense? Okay. And last little... Oh, got 3 minutes. The atomic theory of Kanada, compared to that of Democritus and Leucippus? Whatever. The ancient Greek philosophers Democritus and Leucippus developed an atomic theory which some modern Western scholars believe was borrowed by Kanada. They always have to do that, right? Besides the fact that there's no proof that Kanada borrowed from the Greeks, the two theories are dissimilar in significant ways. Kanada taught that the atoms of water have qualities of smell, color, taste, and temperature. The atoms of light have qualities of color and temperature. And the atoms of air have the quality of temperature. But the Greeks do not attribute such qualities to the atoms. So it's much more developed. Another difference between the two theories is found in their explanation of motion. For the Greeks, the very nature of atoms was motion, but not so for the atoms of Kanada, which he held to be by nature inactive. Atoms are set into motion by the force of adrishta. If the atom is already active, then what are we doing? You know what I'm saying? If the atoms aren't active according to our activities, then what's the meaning of good and bad? Because they're working anyway. So it's just a matter of, you know, do you jump? You know, it's just a matter of jumping out of the way when the truck comes, and that's all the more you can do. You know what I'm saying? So the motion is therefore, because pradan does not move. Only because time has been introduced into that, into the mahat, then there's movement. But that movement is based on the desire of the living entities, their false ego. That's what comes. So in the glance of the Lord, then that comes the jivas, it comes their karma or their desires, material desires, and it comes time and false ego. Right? So all that it comes in, then pradan turns into mahat. Right, so because of that activeness there, seemingly activeness, therefore the Greeks are making this mistake. Though it's understood is that it's actually the adrishta that's making it work. The Greek atomists devised a thoroughly mechanistic law that was supposed to govern atomic phenomena. But Kanada thought that atoms are not only ruled by mechanical laws, but also by the moral laws of karma. Right, so that's what's missing in the Greek, is that if it's already active, because if there's karma, that would be the cause of action. But if the atoms are already active, then there's no need of the law of karma. And therefore, we see in the Western philosophies in that, karma isn't really part of it. Because unfortunately, if the Greeks didn't think it, the Westerners don't think it either. Like that, they're limited back to the Greeks. So unless they get it from somewhere else, from farther east, then the concept of karma just isn't there. Other than a very minimal, okay, I do good work, I get a result, but that's right now. But past work, that's why I'm in the situation I'm in, that we only see from the Eastern philosophies. Like that. Western don't have it. For Democritus, behind atoms was only the void. Kanada admitted the existence of God behind the atoms. Democritus believed that even souls are composed of atoms. Kanada held that souls, being spiritual, are distinct from atoms. Right? So he's not making a distinction between the spiritual and the material. It's just that's what's there. There's God, spiritual. There's the souls that are spiritual. Then there's all these other atoms that are there. And so according to the good, the nature of the living entity, he will perform his different activities. Based on his past karma, he'll be in present situations. Based on the present situations, what he does will create his future destiny. And then that will be controlled by the supreme will. So he's just seeing this whole thing like this. That's all. And while these Western philosophers, then they're not able to see anything beyond why they would be there. So the atoms themselves have to be the active principle, because they've left out karma and they've left out God. Right, so that means who's making the atoms move? Right, so it has to be the atoms are moving themselves. But if you accept the soul and God, then and karma, then you can understand that the atoms are moving by the will of the Lord according to the desire of the living entity. Does that make sense? Okay. So yeah. Okay, so that ends then Vaisheshika. And then today is what? Thursday. So tomorrow we'll begin with Shankhya. Non-theistic dualism. Om Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare. Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. Jai Srila Prabhupada ki, Sarva Veta Bhaktivinoda ki, Jai Nitai Gaura Premananda.